Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. Immigration is shaping up to be a key issue in the presidential campaign, and 11 million undocumented immigrants are watching to see whether they'll have a path to citizenship or see their deportation prioritized. The bombings over the weekend in New York and New Jersey have reignited debate over how immigrants and refugees enter the U.S., and today we'll talk with representatives of our region's Hispanic and Muslim communities to explore how the campaign narratives are affecting those communities. All that along with your calls after this news from NPR. Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis, and we are at 6 minutes past the hour on a pretty dreary and soggy afternoon. That rain, by the way, expected throughout the afternoon into the rush hour this evening, so do be careful out there. It will also continue into tomorrow as well, so we will not dry out for the next 48 hours or so. We are tracking two, and by we, I mean the National Weather Service. No one here is, we have no weather people on the staff, just to be clear. But they are tracking two tropical storms, both of which are expected to remain out to sea. So we always like to keep an eye on those things. So we'll do that throughout the afternoon right here on 89.5. By the way, later this afternoon, All Things Considered has a great lineup for you to accompany you on that ride home, which may be complicated by some water. So you'll have a lot of company on that ride home. Today, we're continuing our series of conversations about the issues that are shaping campaign 2016. And our subject today is immigration. The folks who analyze social media say that immigration has been responsible for about 18% of Twitter traffic that's built around core election issues. So there's a lot of interest in this. Our numbers are 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Of course, you can also give us your thoughts on the immigration issue and how it's shaping up in this presidential campaign at our Facebook page as well. The immigration debate certainly intensified over the weekend with those bombings in New York and New Jersey. The New York City bomber was reportedly born in Afghanistan before becoming a U.S. citizen. In response to that news, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump said the government doesn't know enough about people coming from countries with terror connections to allow them to keep coming into the United States. Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton said yesterday she has long supported improvements to the country's ability to vet immigrants, and should she be elected, she plans within her first 100 days in office to introduce comprehensive immigration reform. Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, says we should focus on creating a more efficient system of providing work visas, doing background checks, and re-incentivizing non-citizens to pay taxes, quote, get proof of employment, and otherwise assimilate, unquote. Prior to the weekend bombings, Mr. Trump has called for a giant wall along the U.S. southern border, which he has said Mexico will pay for. Mexico says it will not, and he's argued for a temporary halt on all immigration from Muslim countries. He has since backed away from that proposal in favor of a ban on immigration from any nation that has been compromised by terror. Adding to the debate is the news yesterday that more than 800 people who had been ordered to be deported or removed from the U.S. were granted citizenship. The Department of Homeland Security discovered the error, which had to do with incomplete fingerprint records, which the department says it's taking steps to correct. All of this creates quite a noisy conversation around immigration and the 2016 election, and we were curious about the impact of the election rhetoric on the two largest communities at the center of the debate, the Hispanic community and the Muslim community. So we invited several guests to join us today. First, we are happy to welcome back Beatrice Amberman, who is the vice chair of the Virginia Latino Leaders Council. She's also the national vice president of the Mexican American Coalition. Beatrice, nice to see you again. Thank you
always
for being here.
Always nice to see you, Kathy, and thank you for the invitation.
You're so welcome. Certainly, we know that that this issue of immigration has dominated the campaign in many respects. Hispanics, the largest ethnic minority in the United States, and certainly more Hispanics will be going to the polls this time around just by sheer numbers, something like 3,000 more Hispanics eligible to vote every day in this country. And so I wonder, this conversation around the wall, this conversation around the visit of Donald Trump to visit with the Mexican president, how is that playing out in the Hispanic community here in Hampton Roads?
Well, definitely we think that the conversation has been overly simplified. Anything that has to do with a relationship between two nations that are neighbors for quite a long time has deep resonance in many areas. One of them is the economic, and of course, the human relationship between those two nations. And Mexico has been an extremely good neighbor of the United States of America. As a matter of fact, in all the years that we have had, you have never had this neighborhood relationship. You never have seen conflicts along the borders. We are a friendly nation, and we agree with you. Mm. I feel that the immigration system has to be reformed. We are concerned about that. And I think people of any nationality knows that the immigration system is pretty slow. And that desperation of having this lagging into having a resolution to your application is what impulses a lot of people to do things that are not right.
So this is interesting, because I think, you know, you nailed it when you said there's a lot of people around this debate who feel strongly that our immigration system needs to be overhauled. I always like to think about getting to the part where we agree, getting down to what we all agree on, so that we can build something something on that. So as your community looks at immigration, what do you think are reforms that you would agree that need to be made that would sort of resonate with other communities?
And actually, what you mentioned, the list of things that we have mentioned for many, many years are all the things that you mentioned. There is a system in which we can make sure that everybody that is in America is registered somewhere, that we know their real names, where their addresses are. It behooves America, and for security reasons, to know. And without any system whatsoever, you have people that actually we don't know who they are and so forth. So what we're saying,
you're as concerned about that as other people are.
Yeah. And what we're saying is people are waiting for them to pay taxes, to do everything that it takes to get into the system. And this is what we're saying, that there must be one priority that we take care of within these years, instead of fighting and dividing America.
So I want to ask you what you've been hearing from members of your community about this conversation about the wall. Because if you look at the campaign issue of immigration, you cannot get into that but a sentence or two before the wall comes up.
And actually, that is also oversimplified, because we don't take into consideration that if there is one relationship that impacts very much the life of Americans, it's actually their relationship with Mexico. And I wanted to share a couple of numbers with you. And one of those is that the bilateral trade between Mexico and the United States is about $531 billion. And this is $1 million per minute. And when we're talking about that, a lot of people think that it is just America buying or helping Mexico. But in reality, I want to share with the public that Mexico is the first trading partner of America, second to Canada. There is no other country in the world that buys more products from America than Mexico. Canada is first, Mexico is second. America buys a lot of products, for instance, from China. And yet, the Chinese don't buy a lot of products from Mexico. This is totally the reverse from Mexico. So the economies are tied. And when Mexico produces things that we export, that Mexico exports to the world, about 40% of those products contain American manufacturing
So economic products. Impacts, tremendous.
It is tremendous.
John Rio Frio is with us today. He's an associate professor of Hispanic Studies at the College of William and Mary. He goes by Rio. So, Professor, nice to have you with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You're specializing in immigration and is your field of study. I wonder how, as a scholar, you observe this particular moment in our history in this presidential campaign and the ways in which you've heard the immigration positions expressed.
It feels remarkably similar. It feels a lot like deja vu. I mean, I think there's sort of a pattern. My field is Latino studies more broadly. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you really realize when you start to study immigration over periods of time is that the cycles repeat themselves. And so frequently after an economic downturn, you get the kind of suspicion of immigrants, the xenophobia that follows these economic concerns. And then when things sort of even out, we kind of go back to the status quo where we're just sort of like comfortable with immigration in kind of a vague way.
So this has happened before. Familiar. So it feels familiar. Give us a sense of the last time you saw this happening, because I was just trying to think when I've ever heard of that. And I don't know that I can recall a time where it's been more passionate than it is at this moment. But you're the expert. So give us a sense of when it happened previously.
Well, certainly during the Reagan years with the Immigration Reform Control Act, IRCA, labeled amnesty, you saw, and the way that in my field particularly, which is cultural studies, we look at how sort of society in general responds to these larger social dynamics like immigration. And so we'll look at, TV shows and popular culture and political discourse, and you start to see things like the rise in language in which immigrants are referred to as a flood or as a tide. This was huge in the 80s, where there was a sort of sense that we were under, there was an invasion by immigrant communities. You saw it again right around the NAFTA period in the early 90s. And again, the rhetoric sort of focuses in on this notion that immigrants are sort of this invading, kind of dehumanized force. And so the specifics might be slightly different, but the general feeling and the tone and the dynamic is really familiar.
That's really interesting. So just the terminology and the use of words around this issue are a piece of what frames it for us. We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Those are the numbers where you can join us today. Professor Rio Frio is from College of William & Mary, where he is a professor of Hispanic studies, specializing in immigration, Latino culture, racism, and media representation of Latinos. Beatrice Amberman with us in the studio today. She's the vice chair of the Virginia Latino Leaders Council. She's also a commissioner of the Virginia Beach Human Rights Commission and a national vice president of the Mexican American Coalition. So if you are an immigrant to this country, I'd love to hear from you this noon, because we're trying to suss out how it is that this debate is playing out in immigrant communities. So we'd love to hear from you at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Beatrice Amberman, it occurs to me that there are 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country, and I suspect that this debate is deeply concerning, but I wonder, as you've talked with some of these folks, what are they telling you about how this debate makes them feel or move in the community?
Kathy, I want to mention one thing that I feel is very beneficial for all of us to consider. We have 54 million Hispanics in the U.S. Out of those 54 million, we have additionally, say, 11 million undocumented persons. Out of those 11 million, about half of that, or a little more than half, are Hispanic. So mm-hmm. we are talking people of many nationalities. And what we are concerned is that when people are walking by, people assume that just because you look Hispanic, or perhaps they hear a conversation in
accent,
Spanish,
right,
that you immediately are an undocumented. And then there is this sensation that a lot of Hispanic people are undocumented in this country. And actually, the Hispanic presence in North America has been here actually before the English arrived. So in many areas of the country, you will see that the Hispanic population is ancient in that region. Now there are certain areas that population has grown, and that is where the stress comes in, that a lot of people find themselves confronting people speak Spanish, eating foods that they are not familiar with, and then the fear comes, are the people going to be able to assimilate? And let me assure everybody, with years and throughout the history of America, everybody assimilates. It behooves people, to be part of the whole. And what I just wanted to say is that we have to be aware not to have those sentiments be used so that we can turn one against the other.
Mm. Are you seeing that happen?
I feel that in some cases it is. Fortunately, I don't see that in America that happens a lot. Although as the election approaches, I think the people feel more free to be offensive towards other people, to belittle other cultures and so forth. And I just wanted to make everybody aware we are all part of America. Mm. We love America. We want this country to succeed. We want to be a part of that success. And just for one tip of information, a lot of people have to know that the undocumented population, 90% of the immigrant population that is here undocumented are employed. So they're not here just loitering on the streets. They are hardworking people.
And the tax situation, a lot of people are very concerned about
that. And a lot of them, actually, their employers do have a system in which they give them a tax ID number and then they collect from them. Mm-hmm. So they contribute to the system.
And the argument on the other side of that is that these are folks who are contributing to the system, but will not be able to.
They will never go use
the system.
Exactly. And actually get.
Officially.
Officially. Exactly. Yeah. You're correct.
Frank is on the line from Hampton. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Kathy, thank you for the wonderful opportunity that you give us to share our thoughts about this issue of immigration.
You're most welcome.
The United States, Mexico, and Canada are part of NAFTA. Trump ignorantly talks about the hate to immigrants, and he extrapolates the number of illegal Mexicans. The number of illegal Mexicans is overrated. It's not 11 million. It's as the previous speaker in your program said, Mexicans are not 11 million.
No, that's the total number of undocumented.
That is correct,
yes, from all countries.
In the mind of Trump, there is 11 million criminals who are Mexicans, okay? And that's what most Americans believe because he talks nonsense. On the other hand, Trump has a wife that comes from a communist country. He should talk about that. On the other hand, he says he's going to stop people that come from countries that have terrorism. So he should stop people that come from England, that come from France, and many countries, including the United States. We have terrorists here, and we should first focus on helping our country and not imposing nonsense to the poor Mexicans that come here to help work in our farms that no African American wants to work, no Hispanic American wants to work, and no white or Caucasian American wants to work. There is a lot of work that is done by these people. In other societies, they could be classified as the untouchables. In India, our people would be called untouchable.
Mm. Frank, I thank you for the call. This point you make about employment is one that is often brought to bear on this conversation. Rio, I wonder, as you hear what Frank's talking about there, I wonder if you would comment on that, particularly around this area of images of employment. You've taken a good look at how these issues are represented in the media.
Yeah, actually, a couple of points. I wanted to follow up just quickly on something that Beatrice mentioned earlier. You know, when we talk about the Hispanic community, it's kind of a misnomer. We're really talking about Hispanic and Latino communities. And the reason it's an important point is that there's an enormous amount of diversity around Latino communities. Some are born U.S. citizens. For example, if you're Puerto Rican, you are a born U.S. citizen, even if you're born in Puerto Rico. There are Mexican Americans who have been in the country for seven generations. Beatrice alluded to the United States being Spanish speaking before the English arrived. All of California and the sort of Southwest were Spanish speakers. And there's a line that says that the border moved, you know, across them. We also have people that are coming from Central and South America who have sort of radically different experiences with the United States in terms of foreign policy. So Latino communities are exceptionally diverse, and it's hard to characterize them sort of as a single monolith.
Yeah.
Cubans in Florida, for example, have a really, really different history.
Is it true? I don't know if this is correct, but I've heard it said that the U.S. is the only sort of culture that forgive this, but I think you'll understand what I'm saying. It sort of lumps all of those Spanish-speaking countries together in the term Hispanic or Latino.
That is correct.
Well, there's a whole history to that. I mean, in some ways, there's a book. Actually, she's written several books. Her name is Arlene Davila. She's a cultural anthropologist at NYU, and she's written really beautiful, brilliant work on marketing. And so there's a sense in which there has been a kind of benefit to constructing a monolith around Hispanic communities, because if you're able to say, well, I'm an expert in marketing to the Hispanic community, it gives you a sort of global cachet. It's much harder to say, well, I can help you get to some of the Latino communities.
Interesting.
Right? And then I also think that the political situation doesn't help. So in other words, if you have a posture that is sort of decidedly anti-immigrant, then it's really in your best interest to cast Hispanics as a single group, because it allows you to sort of use a shorthand that's negative, and that allows you to sort of make your point more, maybe louder, you know, more obviously. Mm. And so I think that there's a lot of different reasons why people invest in the sort of notion that there's a single Hispanic community, but it's misleading.
Really interesting.
I just really wanted to follow up on Frank's comments, yes, which I thought were, you know, really helpful and insightful. And I think that really, you know, when you're talking about immigration, there's sort of a sub conversation that's happening underneath all of this, and there may be two of them. One is certainly economic insecurity, the notion that immigrants are, there's a concern that they drain our resources and they don't contribute to the economy. There's a concern that they take jobs. All of these things are highly debatable, but most of the work that I've come across has sort of worked to debunk some of these myths. You know, as Beatrice mentioned earlier, you can get a tax ID number without having a social security number. Immigrants, Latino and from other places, will often come to the United States and get social security numbers that are false. They'll contribute to the social security system and then change jobs. So there's ways in which they're contributing amply to a system that desperately needs the funds. Not to mention the fact that they pay sales tax, that they, you know, they purchase things. They don't simply come here and sort of exist. They're very deeply embedded in our economic communities.
That's John Rio Frio, who's an associate professor of Hispanic studies at the College of William & Mary. Beatrice Amberman with us in the studio as well. We're at 28 minutes past the hour, and glad to have Michael Cassidy with us today. He's the founder of the Virginia Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis, and his organization conducts research on economic issues with particular attention to the impacts on low and moderate income people. Michael Cassidy, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Kathy. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you so much. You have really been looking at this issue and looking at it from the perspective of helping us understand what the numbers really say, because numbers, as you know, are very sort of easy to throw around. So what are the numbers that stand out for you when it comes to this immigration conversation we're having as a nation right now?
Sure. So I think that when we look at the role of immigrants in the economy in Virginia, you see that the data reflects very much what the conversation you've been having up till now indicates, that Virginia's immigrant population, for example, is quite large and it's diverse. Virginia immigrants are very well educated, and they're very active in the economy. They're active in the labor market, and they have very solid household incomes. So Virginia's workforce is one of the most highly educated and highest earning in the nation, and that really forms the backbone of an economy that's routinely ranked as a powerhouse. Mm. And the data shows that immigrants play a key role in the Commonwealth's success. I mean, for example, more than 40% of Virginia immigrants have a bachelor's degree or higher. That far exceeds the U.S. as a whole in terms of the foreign-born population, and even exceeds the percentages of the native-born population in the nation as a whole and in the state. So we have a very highly educated immigrant community here in Virginia. And those folks are working. They're attached to the labor market. They're contributing to the economy. The labor force participation rate, which is the rate of folks who are working or looking for work, is about 73% for the foreign-born population in Virginia. It's only 65% for the native-born population. And so that is a good signal about how immigrants are here and they come to this community to contribute and to work. And in our state, almost 20% of Virginia businesses business owners are foreign-born, and they make up over a third of all kind of Main Street businesses, you know, sort of things like dry cleaners and nail salons and barbershops and those sorts of things, those kind of Main Street businesses. So it's really a strong and powerful story about the significant contributions that immigrants make to the economy in our state and what a critical asset they are to our whole community.
So what do you make of this debate that's underway now in the presidential campaign around immigration and around the proposals of the candidates? With the undergirding you've just described that you understand about this, what do you make of this moment we find ourselves in right now?
It's a very disconcerting moment because you have a lot of very strong and negative rhetoric about the role of immigrants in our society and in our community, that so much of which flies in the face of lived experience and what the facts tell us about immigrants, their contributions to our community and to our economy. I think there's a lot to be said for the stagnant wages and struggling economic situation that large segments of the labor force throughout the United States have been struggling with for a good long time, before even the deep recession hit. I think a lot of when you look at history, you see that we are more generous as a people in terms of our social policies, in terms of our sense that we're all in this together during periods of robust economic growth. And we haven't seen that in this country, certainly not at the levels like we did in previous decades where there were, you know, significant reforms of our nation's immigration system to make it broader and more open and more inclusive. And I think that tends to also play a role in constraining our conversation, constraining people's sense of hopefulness, of welcome. And I think that's why it's more important than ever for folks to be looking at these the facts of the situation, really understanding the very important and vital role that immigrants play, so we can have a more balanced conversation about what a vital role that they play.
Michael Cassidy is the founder of the Virginia Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis, and we're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Wondering if you've heard anything in this conversation that was a surprise to you, wondering how you're processing this whole conversation around immigration, which has been a very, very potent issue in this election campaign. To what degree do the candidates' positions on immigration influence you? To what degree are you thinking about those policies as you think about the candidate for whom you will cast your vote in November? 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Alan's on the line from Chesapeake. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hello, Kathy.
Hi.
I appreciate the call. And I believe immigrants from all countries are vital to our continued growth, not just unless speak of immigrants, people often think of food, but it's ideas, it's businesses, it's a different perspective.
Okay.
And while they contribute to the economy, their children also receive services from schools and other benefits, so it is a give and take. However, I've known a few people who've gone through the process of naturalization, which costs, I think it cost them a little over $8,000, and they had to take the test and be sworn in as a citizen. And I'd like to ask your guest what feelings she's hearing in her communities, not just one, but multiple Hispanic communities, because they're not monolithic, towards amnesty.
Ah, So one sort of everybody who's here now is good to go, and we'll start over at zero. Alan, thank you for the call.
I appreciate the question because I feel that that is one of the things, the words that make people fear what that word means. But actually, when we talk about amnesty, what we're talking about is that people fear that with no qualification whatsoever, you would just receive a paper and all of a sudden you become part of the system. And that is not ever what we are saying. What we're saying is that there has to be a system in which people can get back on the line, but make a line. Because as of now, there is absolutely no line, no process whatsoever. And this is what makes the situation seem sort of like unmanageable. What we want is actually, and we have to trust that there are, America is one of the most industrious and intelligent nations. So we know that the government can make possible the fact that we have rules, such as having make people present taxes for several years. Tell us how
so
many years.
You're talking about these folks who are here already.
And what the people
and
are saying is like, just give them blank amnesty. And that is a misnomer in reality, because what we're saying is make a system in which you have qualifications so that people can apply. If you want to say, if you have been here 10 years, if you have worked, there is a line to be made. Go back on the line. Put an application. Make sure that you present documentations that you have been employed, that you have had.
You're talking about those people who are contributing.
And so forth.
Yeah.
And that is what we are talking about. That if we talk about what the Hispanic community has been saying all along, is that, yes, we don't want criminals to be forgiven and to enter the country. It behooves us all to have security. So definitely have a system with check and balances and make sure that the persons that are working out there, you know that there is a possibility as well. And it behooves that also because of the employment situation.
Okay. Who's trying to jump in there? Michael Castor or Rhea?
No, it was Rhea. Sorry,
okay,
I got enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, no worries.
I couldn't agree more with Beatrice's point about the fear, the sort of knee-jerk reaction to the term amnesty. But I also agree with her, too, that I think that what we're really talking about is also recognizing the kinds of contributions that immigrant communities are making to the United States, you know, sort of the way that Michael was talking about. We haven't touched, for example, on the fact that the United States for decades, really going back to before the 1940s, has had both formal and informal networks that looks to procure labor from Central and South America, right? So in other words, we used to recruit very actively during the Bracero program to bring Latino communities to the United States to help us. And then since then, we've had very established informal networks, for example, in agriculture,
sure,
in the poultry industry, in construction. And I think that what we miss when we get into a debate about the concept of amnesty is that we're really not recognizing that there are whole sectors of our population, of our economy, that are very, very dependent on the kinds of labor produced, provided by immigrant communities. And that, you know,
that
if you look
correct
through, and for example, post-2010, after the Arizona HB 1070 law, multiple states followed suit. And in many of those cases, the result was if you Google crops rotting in the fields, what you'll see is really sort of a whole list of states that have had real struggles with trying to understand, deal with the consequences of harsh anti-immigrant measures and what that's done to their local economy.
22 minutes before the hour, that's Professor Rhea Frio from College of William & Mary. Michael Cassidy, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been very helpful to have this fiscal analysis from the Virginia Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis. Appreciate the good work you're doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathy.
20 minutes before the hour, and let's go to Barry on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Barry, you're on the air. Barry, you're on. Okay, we're not going to go to Barry. We're going to go to Dave in Williamsburg. Hi, Dave, you're on the air. Barry, if we dropped you, just give us a call back. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, Kathy.
Hi.
I was listening to the people talk there, and amnesty is just one of those loaded political words that, you know, never going to happen. The lady made a good point. My thing is, I know people. I was out west, and the folks out there, I know folks I went to school with, that have been here, they're Hispanic and other stuff, for decades. And somebody was talking about a line. Well, there is no line. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like in Virginia. They have a problem, and some legislature steps up and says, well, House, well, yeah, we'll do this, but we've got to be slowly, very slowly.
What would a comprehensive plan then, Dave? I hear you about it's slow, and boy, I tell you, a lot of people would agree with you on that, and that it's cumbersome and it's a tough process. If you were single-handedly with waving the magic wand and saying, "All right, this is the plan," what would be some key elements from your perspective?
Okay, number one, how long have you been here? Number two, are you stable? Number three, are you a law-abiding? Number four, have you been paying taxes? Number five, do you have children here? Do you have a family? I am not in favor of the plan that I see coming from some politicians where everybody get out and then stand in line, but again, there is no line, and mm-hmm. then it takes forever and forever and forever. That's the thing. Just hopefully you'll die in line. Mm. Just make it an expedited system, have some very clear markers, and then just process them.
Yeah, and I tell you, Dave, that is something upon which many people agree. I thank you for the call. 19 minutes before the hour, let's go to Lance on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Lance, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, Kathy. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a regular listener.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say I think there's something that the guests are missing, and that is that Virginia as a state, our economy is artificially inflated by the military, so we're able to host big immigrant populations. But I think maybe the concern from other citizens in other states may be that they don't have that investment in their communities. They don't have a huge, their GDP, their growth is not based on the military and all the schools and the hospitals and everything that the military force brings to the area. And maybe that's where some of those fears come from.
Yeah, go ahead, Lance.
Also, there was this great movie. I can't think of the name of the producer or the director right now, but it was called The Day Without Mexicans. Mm. And it really talked about the contributions of immigrants to American society and what would happen if they all disappeared in one day.
Lance,
I'll take my comment.
All right, Lance, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. We're at 18 minutes before the hour. Certainly, there's no question the military community shapes this Commonwealth in so very many ways. Thank you for the call. We're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Rio, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say, I think Lance brings up a really important point. And, again, with regards to our immigration policies, we've had a longstanding commitment to using military service as a path to citizenship. And Latinos currently comprise roughly 11.4% of our military. And in the newest class of recruits, the newest recruitment cycle, it's up to 16.9%. And so I think that part of what Latino communities are trying to voice, and the reason why rhetoric like Trump's, which again his rhetoric is the newest iteration of something that we've seen before, but one of the reasons why Latino communities I think struggle so much with this kind of rhetoric is that it erases all of these very important contributions, including military service, which as we well know is really among the most sort of the biggest sacrifices that you can make as a family. And so I think that Lance brings up a really important point about how Latino communities further contribute in ways that also often get kind of erased by the way we talk about them.
That's John Rio Frio, Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies at the College of William & Mary. John's on the line from Fort Lee. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm visiting Fort Lee, so I'm representing Fort Lee. And first of all, let me thank you for your show. I believe it's one of the best shows that I've had with respect to issues related to immigration, issues related to Hispanics versus Latinos. Mm. My surname is Mendoza, okay? Mm-hmm. And if you say where I come from, northern Spain, but that's, I'm American-born. And I've always had a challenge with respect to who came up with the terms Hispanics or Latino or Chicano, whatever the case may be. There are groups of people, particularly from the American community of Mexican descendants, that often identified with Chicanos. I believe that term was born in Los Angeles, California. Mm. But I think until we get to the point of saying that we're all Americans, even people that come here from other countries that have become legal citizens, they become Americans. I've been in foreign countries, and particularly I was in Spain for three weeks, and one of the unique things about that country, and I believe other countries, other European countries are probably very similar, people that become citizens of that country are Germans, or I can't speak for them, but they're Spaniards or Españolos. They're not, for example, a group of Chinese that became citizens. They said it in Spanish, somos Españolos.
Mm.
Not we're Spanish Chinese or Chinese Spaniards. They became citizens of that country.
Uh-huh.
And we're still struggling here in America with identity.
Yeah, I hear you, John. Identity is certainly at the core of so much of the conversation, and certainly at the core of so much of this conversation in our political process. And thank you for your kind comments from Fort Lee. I hope you stay here a long, long time because you like this show. That makes me happy. John Rio Frio, I want to thank you so much for being with us today from the College of William & Mary. Really appreciate it. Hope we can get you back.
It was my pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. 14 minutes before the hour, Julio is on the line from Williamsburg. Hi, Julio. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
All right.
Just from my point of view, background on me, we immigrated in 78 from Nicaragua fleeing the Sandinista government.
Wow.
And I grew up in Miami. You know, I see that the root cause is, looking at El Salvador, Honduras, all these people are fleeing because of the drug epidemic and the crime that's in those countries. You don't see Panamanians coming over. You don't see Costa Ricans coming over. You know, it's these countries where, you know, they can't live in peace. People are fleeing because of the danger in the economic situation. And it's mostly caused by the drug cartels.
And so
you know,
I hear you. Go ahead.
We need to stabilize those countries and let those people not want to leave their countries, like in Panama and Costa Rica.
So. Fair enough, Julio. And I think that that's probably devoutly to be wished by lots of folks. No question, a one of the causes of immigration. We're at 12 minutes before the hour. I'm going to try to get to you, Earl and Kathy, but I need to go first to Dr. Scott Gerdner, who's a professor of Islamic studies at Randolph-Macon College. He was at Old Dominion and has taught courses on Islamic traditions and the experience and expression of Islam in the United States, as well as popular perceptions of Muslims. Dr. Gerdner, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
I wonder, you know, we asked this question around the Latino/Hispanic community, and there has been so much conversation in this election cycle around, we'll say Muslims, Islamic countries, countries that export terrorism, all of those varying shades in that conversation that tend to get lumped together in this presidential race. And I wonder, as you're talking to friends and colleagues, how are you seeing that conversation experienced by those communities?
Well, it's really disconcerting. It's concerning to see sort of the mainstream acceptance of Islamophobic rhetoric in the campaign and sort of the moderate voices being pushed to the margins. So obviously the majority of American Muslims are not terrorists. They're not going around blowing things up and such. And they're going about their everyday work lives. And as some of the other guests and commenters have observed, you know, one of the really interesting questions is why do perceptions fly in the face so much of the facts? And I think in particular, when we look at the Muslim community, we see people who, if they're immigrants, they've left their homes and villages and families to come to the United States, not out of some hatred for the United States, as it's sometimes presented when, for instance, Trump uses the language that Islam hates us, but as your previous guests have observed, this sort of xenophobic anti-immigrant rhetoric is not exclusive to Trump. When that language is used, it doesn't really make sense of why the Muslim American community has come to the United States and what motivates them. Many of them are upset about their experience with Islamophobia as Americans, not just as Muslims, their sense of what their rights are and what the ideals of the country hold for them.
I wonder, we're at this moment in the presidential race. There's been a lot of conversation about polling. This race right now looks like a dead heat. And I hear your concerns about Islamophobia and the concerns that have been front and center in this campaign. How concerned are you about that, both today and on November 9th? In some respects, the conversation has been there. I wonder what happens for your community on November 9th with a presidential race that's neck and neck.
Well, I think it's going to be a sort of confrontation with America's soul and our conscience, what's our identity. And of course, as has been observed, there's a cycle of xenophobia and sort of unnatural human fear of the unknown and the unfamiliar that is awfully tempting in times of economic and other crises to turn to. But we are a nation founded on different values with different principles. And so what will we choose to be and how will we execute that, I think, is going to come to terms on Election Day. It's really, again, just disconcerting to see this rhetoric of anti-Islamic communities made mainstream. And so we also see along with that a spike of attacks on Muslims. So, for instance, a colleague was recently, who's an engineer at NASA, she was just recently accosted and told to go home. So she represents actually the norm in the Muslim American community. She has an advanced degree. She's working in a well-paying, a job that requires a high education. And yet she's perceived somehow as not being a part of the American way of life because she chooses to cover her hair.
And so you note there have been increases in violence. There have been increases in angry rhetoric. And so I wonder, what do people like that woman that you've described, what do they do in the face of that? Because there has to be a calculation you make about whether this is potentially dangerous for you to respond in the moment.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this is one of the issues that's really highlighted, that many minority and sort of communities that don't have as much privilege often have to walk that line exactly. What can I do? What's practical in this case? And so there's this perception, particularly, I think, with Trump's campaign, that there seems to be an elite double standard, that his wife's immigration represents the good immigrant, and then he can construct these images of the bad immigrants. And the communities themselves have to deal with this all the time. Can I speak out safely here? Can I express my experience as an American, as a Muslim, in this context safely? So I think it's not appreciated to the extent to which this is this rhetoric of Islamophobia is terrorizing. It's creating a community that's afraid to speak out. And that's unfortunate because the Muslim community is an incredible resource for the United States, not least of all in fighting Islamic extremism abroad and unfortunately the United States itself.
The New York Times reported on Sunday that that hate crimes against Muslim Americans are the most, against American Muslims, I should more properly say, are the most in the post 9/11 era. We're at 8 minutes before the hour, and it's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. We're talking about the Hispanic/Latino community and what they're experiencing in the wake of these conversations related to the election. And we're also talking about the Muslim community. We'd love to hear from you. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers where you can join us today. And we're talking with Dr. Scott Gerdner, who's a professor of Islamic studies, teaching at Randolph-Macon College. Beatrice Amberman remains with us today, the national vice president for the Mexican-American Coalition, who is also a commissioner on the Virginia Beach Human Rights Commission. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Are the numbers where you can join us today. Earl is on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Earl. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Yes, I am a regular listener.
Thank you.
But what I wanted to say is I'm an immigrant. I immigrated to this country in the mid-60s.
Uh-huh.
From
where?
Yes.
From where?
From the Caribbean,
got
Jamaica.
It. Okay.
I got my citizenship. I went in the military as an enlisted man, retired as a commissioned officer, And I feel that I contribute a lot to this country. I feel I'm just as American as anyone else does. However, I often think that the politicians, especially the Trump campaign, scapegoat immigrants. And in a sense, some of the business community, I don't think that they want a legal path for the immigrants, in that by not having a legal path, they could give them substandard wages and not pay them or not bring them into the system while abusing them, in a sense. But I think it's also crazy that this country is a country of immigrants, and as long as the European immigrants were coming in, there wasn't an issue. Now that they're immigrants of other colors, now it's a big issue. And I'll take my comments off the line.
Okay, Earl, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Beatrice Emberman, I'm going to come to you, and then I'm going to go to Dr. Scott Gardner.
Thank you very much, Kathy. And it is very exciting to hear all these opinions. And I wanted to basically mention the Hispanic community is comprised with 21 different nations. And the United States of America right now is the second largest Spanish-speaking country in the world. And I wanted to say something because, you know, we have to be conscientious of the fact that there is diversity and there will always be diversity in America. We have to learn to embrace it and not fear it. Mm. And actually, we have to feel proud of the fact that, yes, there are, everybody has an individual characteristic, and we should not treat that as a threat. Mm. Nobody, not even in families, people are the same. And so what I wanted to say here is that we have to make sure that wherever we are part of the constructive conversation, not take the opportunity to diminish others or to take the humanity of other communities into an easy target.
Beatrice Emberman, thank you for being with us today. Dr. Scott Gardner, I'm going to ask you to comment on what our caller just posed as sort of a nefarious intent around this.
Well, you know, I think it points to a fact that is just that, as was noted by the previous guest, immigrant communities bring real value to the country, and so people are going to find ways to exploit that. Even if it's not necessarily a conscientious agenda, or if it is, people have and do benefit regularly in this country from immigrant labor. And if we adopt different policies, there will be other ways to benefit from the value of immigrant labor. That's true of whether we're talking about the Muslim American community or the Latino community. And both of these communities share, as your previous guest noted, an incredible diversity ethnically and in terms of nationality. And so they have a great deal to contribute to the United States as a pluralistic society.
Dr. Scott Gardner, I want to thank you so much for being with us today from Randolph-Macon College. Very much appreciate you being in the conversation today, a professor of Islamic studies. I hope we can get you back. Thank you so much. We're at coming up on 1 minute before the close of the show. I want to thank Beatrice Emberman for being with us. I want to thank Michael Cassidy from the Virginia Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis and Associate Professor John Rio Frio from the College of William & Mary. Up next here on 89.5, it's the Thomas Jefferson Hour. If there's something you didn't get to say in the course of today's conversation, you can always post it on our Facebook page. You can also email us at hearsay@whrv.org. At 8 o'clock tonight on WHRO TV 15, it's the Contenders, 16 for 16. It's Dean Ann Buchanan, the outspoken doctor and former governor of Vermont, and the equally outspoken political commentator are profiled as well. So that's coming up tonight at 8 on WHRO TV 15. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening.